Were you born on here?
No, I wasn't born here. I was born and came to California with my parents when they moved here in 1915. And that was my first time in Long Beach 13.
Do you really remember that?
No, I don't. Well, I remember some things because there were some pictures taken in Los Angeles, and I remember being there then. That was the south part of Los Angeles, probably south of Vernon. And the palm trees were very low, but now they're sky high. So, but I remember coming in 1915, all right. We lived at a little house on at 1703 Atlantic.
What did your family do?
My father came out to go into the fish canning business. And
what had he done in Tennessee?
Well, in Tennessee, he had worked in his father's office as a bookkeeper or clerk, I suppose. And my grandfather was in a sawmill business there. And my grandfather left Tennessee about 1911, so my father must have stayed on at the office until 1915 at least. And
how did you find out about the fish canning business?
Well, his brother had come to Los Angeles previously. He came about 1910, I suppose, because he was interested in he was a chemist, and he wanted to go into the soft drink business, and he thought that the orange flavor would be a good soft drink. So he came to California because of the oranges. There were oranges here, and he thought that would be the basis for his soft drink, I believe. And when he was here, he thought that the tuna canning business would be good for my father to come in. He recommended him coming on out here then. So after his father moved to Los Angeles in 1911, my father probably wanted to come on to another business. Well, he was kind of glad to get away from this little town in Tennessee, because about that time, apparently, there was a lot of trouble in the little town that they lived in. It's called Greenfield, Tennessee. And the people that lived in Greenfield wanted to keep the town dry. No liquor, no alcoholic liquor in the town. And there was a faction that apparently wanted to have liquor there. And these two factions were feuding. And the wet people threatened the other dry people with fires. They burnt the one man for the dry side was the principal of a school, and they burnt down the school. And one of the other persons was apparently in the lumber business, and they burnt down his lumber shed where he kept the lumber. And I didn't know it at the time, but apparently my father was afraid that they would burn down his house. My father was an electrician. In fact, he graduated from School of Engineering, I guess, with a major in electricity at Harvard in 1899. So he rigged up something around the house, an electric wire somehow, so that the current was broken and the alarm would go off. And as a child, I kind of remember him doing something with a wire around the house, but thought nothing of it, of course. So I think my father was kind of afraid to live in town. That may have been one reason he was glad to leave the little town.
Was he wet or dry?
He was dry. He was for the dry side. And Oh, there were several. There were a lot of fires around in the little town. Of course, in reading the history, things in those days, there were a lot of fires because people heated with coal oil lanterns and lamps and had open fireplaces for heat. And being no organized fire department or water system, you know, there were a lot of fires in those days. However, it seemed like there's a lot of fires nowadays, too, in cities. They're reported.
What did your grandfather do in Los Angeles?
Oh, well, my grandfather came to retire in Los Angeles. He had a very interesting career. In fact, his mother started a diary in 1860. Four, something like this. But my grandfather at that time was about 16 years old. But his father died. And then my great-grandmother stayed home for a while, and then she went one Christmas to visit a daughter in, I think it was toward In Indiana somewhere, and stayed for Christmas and then stayed on for a longer time later. So my father took up the diary, and he started the diary about 1846 or 47. There was an interval of just a few months that there's no diary. And he kept a diary from then on until after he died. After he died, my aunt kept up the diary. My grandfather died in 1923, I believe, and my aunt kept it going until perhaps toward 1930. And then she made fewer and fewer entries in it and finally quit it. But my grandfather had one brother and four sisters, and his father and mother were from Connecticut. I don't know what my great grandfather did, but he was he had kind of small hotels. I guess they were all in the country. They were small hotels, a sort of guest house for travelers to stay in. That's one thing he did. And because some of his children worked worked in the table, and they must have been pretty nice places. My great grandfather was a I guess he was left an orphan. And he was apprenticed to a man named Blakesley. Blakesley, and it was spelled with a double E. They make a great point out of it, B-L-A-K-E-S-L-E-E. And he was apprenticed to this cabinet maker, Blakesley. And he must have been an apprentice to him when he was It just said small. And the diary says when he was small, he became apprentice to this Mr. Blakesley. And he stayed with Mr. Blakesley for some time and later married the Blakesley's daughter. I suppose she was the oldest daughter of how many I've forgotten. And then they lived in Utica, New York, where there was a two daughters born. My grandfather was about the youngest. There was one younger child who died, a girl. But my grandfather was the youngest of that family. The great grandfather's name was Porter Ward. And from Utica, New York, they came west for they thought there was better opportunities for real estate, actually. And they came west. I think they went back to Utica, and then they came back west again and settled. They surveyed, they checked over the areas around Lake Michigan. And the story is that they thought that the east side would be better because the west side, where Chicago developed, was sort of swampy land. So they settled around in Indiana, near La Porte, Indiana. I think at that time it was just La Porte County, which was about 40-something. And so there's my grandfather and his brother and four sisters. I think my grandfather might have been a favorite. Or maybe his father thought he had the best business ability, because his mother gave him considerable money. Where the money came from, we don't know. Either the Blakesley family had it, or my great-grandfather was a man of some means, at least. Because my grandfather at least got a start from some money his mother gave him, and he bought a farm up near St. Joe, Michigan, a berry farm. He worked hard. They had to clear all the land, and then he and a brother-in-law, who was an immigrant from Germany, his name was John Beers. He was a little older than my grandfather, by about 16 years older, I think. But my grandfather and John Beers worked together. They worked hard. They cleared the land and sawed up the wood and sold it for shingles and for barrel staves, and they grew things on their farm and traded the wheat or the grain for other supplies. He sold his berries and fruit, and not only ran the farm, but then he got interested in the town of St. Joe, Michigan, working for a person named Wilcox, who had kind of a sawmill and made barrel staves or fruit boxes or something. And then he bought half interest in the Wilcox company business somehow. This must have been when he was maybe 19 or 20 years old. And my grandfather built his own house there in St. Joe, and helped build the first schoolhouse there. I think he supplied the wood for the schoolhouse and built it. And there were other sawmills in St. Joe, and the Wilcox Company changed names or changed hands and merged with other companies. And my grandfather had considerable mechanical ability, and he sort of supervised the steam plant to run the sawmill and to do the mechanical part of it, and his partners then attended more to the buying and selling of the wood and manufacturing of the boxes or something. My grandfather had something to do with the running the mill and manufacturing of boxes too, and he was quite successful. He was quite successful. Business was very good, and he made the considerable money. And then there was a man from came from Canada. His name was Wells, Adam W. Wells. who came to St. Joe. Mr. Wells was older than my grandfather, but Mr. Wells must have been a man of considerable means, because he bought into the sawmill business and to the banking business, and also became a partner in the Cooper Wells knitting factory. And so the sawmill and wood business and box business was very good. The knitting business was, the Cooper Wells business was an interesting thing, because it was started by a Mr. Cooper, who was a Methodist minister. And this Mr. Cooper was a probably a district superintendent of something, of the Methodist Church in north part of Michigan and Indiana or something. And Sam Cooper married my grandfather's sister, Mary. And the Coopers were very wealthy people. And the knitting business expanded, and they finally set up the knitting businesses in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And then I guess the Cooper Wells business really flourished. And of course, later it's been bought out by different companies, but I think there's still a Cooper's knitted underwear business. The Wells, and the Cooper family, there were several girls and boys in that family, and there was one son named Willis Cooper who was not, I forgot whether he was the oldest one or not. I don't think he was the oldest one of the family. But he must have been a very fine person. I've seen pictures of him. He's a smart, bright-looking young man. And he was interested in church work as his father had been. And this Willis Cooper organized a young people's meeting, apparently, at the St. Joe Methodist Church, which later this group of people went into the Epworth League movement, which was sort of starting out then. I believe when the Epworth League started, there were several different organizations that went together to form this league. So I thought that Willis Cooper was one of the founders of the Epworth League, but apparently not. He was a founder of one of the groups that went into the Epworth League. And later, I guess he moved into work. He lived with his family in Kenosha, Wisconsin. His name was Henry, of course, and my grandfather's name was Henry, and my grandfather must have liked him very much. But Henry Cooper and his brother, Charles, I believe, went to see the a play at the Iroquois Theater in Chicago, and it was during the holidays. I think it was New Year's Day evening, and was it 1903? I've forgotten. But there was a fire at the Iroquois Theater, fire, and I guess all of the people, well, many people there were killed, including this Willis Cooper and his brother. Apparently, there was no asbestos curtain in those days. And so after that, I think in the theaters, they'd have an asbestos curtain. It would say asbestos on there, too. Asbestos. I remember going to some theaters, and it'd say asbestos on this curtain that would come down. But anyhow, Willis Cooper was killed in the Iroquois Theater fire. Well, my grandfather's business in St. Joe was very good, and there were different partners. And There's Mr. Wells, and he took, there's also a Mr. Higlin, whose family had been in the business of box business. Lord Higlin, and then Mr. Wells was with Cooper also in the knitting business, Cooper Wells, and a Mr. Kent. Came into the business too, and my grandfather and Mr. Kent went to Tennessee. Apparently, they thought that they'd heard that there was good timberland, I guess, and good place for a box factory in Tennessee, because there had been another business in St. Joe that had moved to Tennessee or had a branch in Tennessee. And one of the men who worked in this other company was as a young man was Mr. Tully. His name was I can't think of his name right now, though I know it. Anyhow, my grandfather moved to Tennessee with Mr. Kent, and they had a box factory there. And later, several box factories merged and formed what they call the Anderson Tully Company in Memphis, Tennessee. And that merger took place in 1889, but my grandfather stayed with his part of the merger in Greenfield until 1911. The history of the Anderson Tully Company is really tremendous. In fact, we've been working on the history of that, and a book will be coming out very soon. It's to be published by the University Press, University of Tennessee. And I helped to give them some information on that from my grandfather's diaries. So now it's the Anderson Tully Company, because some of the partners the only partners who are in it anymore is the Tully. And I have an honorary title of being on the board of directors of this, because of my grandfather, I'm sure because of the ward name. And there's also in the company, one of the board of directors, on the board of directors, is a Mr. Bushing, who was apparently the trustee or executor or manager of the Wells estate. The Kent business is out. They sold out. The Higlin family died off. The Addison company sold out. And so actually, the Tullys are running it, but they've It's quite a company right now. It's managed. The president is a John Tully, who is a wonderful person. In fact, he has a wonderful business ability, and he's very intelligent. He graduated from Columbia University at the age of 18, and stayed on as sort of an instructor until he was 21 years old. He thought he was too young to leave the environments of a university. And his brother, John, is now in the vice president of the company, and some of the Tully descendants have jobs, and then other people who have come into the business have been all of tremendous ability. So
it in silk boxes?
No, they don't make the fruit boxes because in the early days, pasteboard became a new product, and everything was made out of cardboard. And although some of the wood, I guess, went into the cardboard, the making of the cardboard, the wood products, but they made other things. The automobile industry was coming along pretty good about these days, so the Anderson Tully Company supplied the hardwood for the wooden spokes in the wheels, and the wooden parts of the body, and a lot of automobile parts. In fact, they supplied so much of the hardwood to General Motors that the Anderson Tully Company could almost be considered as a part of the General Motors automobile business. But that subsided. As far as automobiles are concerned, they use some of the hardwood which goes into the flooring of trucks. The Fraunhofer line trucks have the wood floors made by the Anderson Tully Company, and also the Land Sea Trucking business have the Anderson Tully floors. And Anderson Tully makes frames for furniture. Actually, the furniture companies now tell them what frames they want, and they cut out the frames there, and when they send it, then they don't have to send a whole lot of waste. They just send just the parts that they need. So they supply a lot of wood for the parts that way. And then some of the forests have been cut down. Of course, they keep repeating them. They only cut down the trees that thin out the forests that are necessary, or if they find some trees are not growing just right, or there's going to be something there, they'll cut them down. But they have quite they employ quite a few foresters to check over their forest now. They have a lot of forests. In fact, they have forests in every state that touches the Mississippi River. And they look after their forests very carefully. In fact, they have one or two helicopters now to survey the forests and also survey the other work that they're doing. One of the subsidiaries of the Anderson Tully Company is work on the river. In the early days, they had to, of course, they still do bring the logs down by, float them down by the water, and have to go back up, and they had some boats on the river and would have to repair piers or levees or something. So they developed a subsidiary to the Anderson Tully Company of the Patton Tully Company, which is water works only. Now they do a lot of repair works and rock works and building dikes and dams and piers and transportation. They make their own barges, and they barge the lumber back and forth, rocks, and all kind of things. They have the present time the biggest fleet of river boats on the Mississippi, and some big, powerful boats.
So this was your grandfather's
company? Yeah, that's his company. And when he retired, he owned 1/6 of the stock in the Anderson Tully Company.
And so he retired to Los Angeles?
Yeah, he retired to Los Angeles in 1911.
And he came to live in South L.A.?
No, he moved to 151 South Virgil Avenue. That was along the car line, the streetcar line, going out west toward Hollywood. In fact, the H car line stopped at H for Heliotrope Drive in Hollywood, which isn't too far from where the campus of the I guess that's a state college out there on Vermont, North Vermont now. It used to be UCLA.
Yeah, it's LA City College.
Yeah, LA City College, and before that it was a normal school for teachers only.
Yeah.
So that's where the end of the streetcar line was. And my uncle had come out, and he was living in Boyle Heights area, of course, in those days. But my father came to Long Beach to go into the tuna canning business. And apparently he'd been here for a short time.